As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Morning, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Echoes of 1972. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koshenka, on this Memorial Day Monday, May 27. Glad you could be with us, and here's what we have for you this hour.
The 2020 presidential race may have storylines similar to those in 1968 and 1972.
On the tech front, how cell phone numbers are the new Social Security numbers.
For Memorial Day, a story of an Air Force vet walking across the country to raise awareness about veterans' issues.
And when passwords remain with couples, even when they divorce.
There are privacy concerns to think about as well. Do you want somebody, being able to see your viewing habits or your listening habits, or in the case of a cell phone plan, depending on who the primary account holder is, who you're calling or texting. So there are serious privacy concerns to consider in doing this.
Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Krauss on when Netflix passwords are forever. She's here in about 20 minutes. The scenario sounds familiar. Democrats facing a Republican presidential candidate widely reviled among the party's rank and file nominate a seemingly safe establishment figure to keep their hold on the White House. To the party's shock and horror, their establishment figure loses the general election. The reviled Republican becomes president. Could 1968 and 1972 reappear not only as it did in 2016, but in the presidential race of 2020? Here's Wall Street Journal Executive Washington Editor Jerry Seib. Jerry, how do you see it?
There's an interesting precedent that Democrats might want to think about in terms of the cycle that they're in now and their move ideologically to the left, which is kind of what you're seeing in the Democratic National Party today. Some people look at a similar situation in the past and wonder if they're hearing echoes of it now. And the parallel is to 1968 and 1972 for Democrats. In 1968, Democrats had been in the White House for 8 years, just as Democrats had been in 2016. They faced a Republican that liberals really disliked intensely, Richard Nixon, just as liberals dislike Donald Trump now. To defeat Richard Nixon in 1968, the Democrats picked a very safe establishment candidate, Hubert Humphrey, who was in fact the vice president then, and he lost. In a close election, he lost to Richard Nixon. This made the liberals in the Democratic Party very angry and very upset, and they thought the party needed to show its true ideological colors more and be bolder. So in 1972, the party had moved to the left and nominated George McGovern, a much more liberal candidate, who then got swamped by Richard Nixon. He lost 49 out of 50 states. So you fast forward to today and you think, well, Democrats nominated Hillary Clinton, a centrist establishment, in 2016. They lost to Donald Trump. The liberal wing of the party is outraged by that. They're saying, let's stop compromising with moderate candidates. Let's be bolder and pick somebody from the left. There's a lot of energy on the left of the party. Does history repeat itself? Do the Democrats nominate a more liberal candidate and then basically lose re-election to Donald Trump as a result? That's the scenario that is interesting to ponder today.
All right. So as you point out, or somebody pointed out in your piece providing analysis here, the Vietnam War was a factor back then. What about now? What is there a similar type of issue?
The issue is Donald Trump in many ways, but in some ways it was Richard Nixon in 1972. Again, the hatred of Richard Nixon among Democrats was almost as intense as the hatred of Donald Trump is among Democrats today. The big difference is that there was a giant additional issue in 1972, which is the Vietnam War. And the difference between then and now is that a lot of the reason George McGovern was nominated was that he, not just that he was a more liberal candidate, but that he was the strongest anti-war candidate. And that factor isn't something similar to that or parallel to that on the stage today. So it's not a perfect parallel, and I think that's the biggest reason that it isn't. The other parallel may be that Democrats may simply be in a more pragmatic mood now than they were then. It may not seem that way because in the early primary season, party activists, and particularly liberal party activists, make a lot more noise, but over time, more centrists and quieter primary voters have their say, too.
Speaking with Wall Street Journal Executive Washington Editor Jerry Seib. So revisit something you just said. Am I understanding correctly that back then, liberals despised Richard Nixon more than liberals today despise Donald Trump?
Well, not more than, but I think in a similar way. And you have to remember, by 1968, liberals had had years and years of Richard Nixon to build up animus. You know, he had been vice president for Dwight Eisenhower for 8 years. He ran for governor of California and lost, and he reappeared on the national stage in 1968. So by then, he had been on the national stage for well more than two decades and was seen as a real arch conservative for most of that period, and somebody who was pretty visceral in his attacks on the liberal establishment in some way. So there was a lot more anger from the left directed at Richard Nixon than some people may remember now.
Is there a particular candidate in the Democratic presidential primary race that would be most likely to bring about a revisit of 68 or 72?
It's a little too early to say that. I mean, there's a lot of energy on the left, and the two most prominent candidates on the left are Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. But I think, you know, they're both more complicated figures, and there are other candidates who are going to emerge with a kind of a more liberal message as well. But I think if you were to name two people who might fit that description, it's probably Senators Warren and Sanders.
Thanks, Jerry. It's Wall Street Journal Executive Washington Editor Jerry Seib. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for spending part of your Memorial Day with us. After decades of earnest public information campaigns, Americans are finally recycling. Airports, malls, schools, and office buildings across the country have bins, right, for plastic bottles and aluminum cans, newspapers. In some cities, you can be fined if inspectors discover that you have not recycled appropriately. But now much of that carefully sorted recycling is ending up in the trash, and in some cases, just being incinerated because it's cheaper. Alana Semuels at The Atlantic has been looking into it. She's based in San Francisco. Alana, what has happened?
So China used to take our recycling for decades, and last year it stopped taking most of them. And so all these cities and towns that have finally convinced people to recycle, to sort their recycling, you know, put their bottles and cans and paper in a blue bin and their trash in a black bin, are finding that there's nowhere to send it, and it costs a lot to send it, you know, somewhere else to get it recycled. And so it's actually cheaper to just put it in a landfill or burn it. So they're just lumping it in with the trash and throwing it away.
My goodness. I know it was a town, I think, in New Hampshire, you said. They just started burning these plastics, knowing that that's not great for the environment, but they felt they had no other choice.
Yeah, it's a town that had a fair share of low-income people, and the costs were pretty black and white. It was $125 a ton to recycle and $68 a ton to incinerate, so about half the cost to just burn it. So, you know, they didn't love the idea of burning it, but they didn't feel like they had much of a choice.
And along those lines, didn't one town face a cost increase from like $6 a ton to $125 or something after China made its decision?
Yeah, so there were a few towns that actually were making money, or at least their recycling program was revenue neutral. And then once China stopped, all these recyclers said, you have to pay us. We're not going to pay you anymore. You have to pay us to take this away. And I think that's kind of the theme with this, is for a long time, Americans have just thought, oh, it's okay if I consume this because I just put it in the recycling and it gets made into what it was again. And that's really just not how it works. There's a big cost to throwing things away, but we haven't really had to pay it so far.
What's the biggest issue for us? Is it plastic, glass, paper, aluminum, all the
above? It really depends on where you are. Plastic, I would say, is a big one. You know, in San Francisco, where I live, glass is actually, there's a pretty good market for glass, and so they can make it back into glass bottles pretty quickly. In a lot of other places, glass is very heavy, so it's really hard to recycle it. Akron, Ohio, for instance, just stopped recycling glass. But plastics are tough because there's so many different types of plastics. I mean, I started trying to count how many plastics I touched on a daily basis, and, you know, you lose count after a couple minutes. And the other problem with plastics is that there are a lot of really little ones. And so if you think of, you know, you throw something in the recycling and then the truck comes and picks it up, think about a straw or a soy sauce packet or a ketchup packet. Those things are probably going to fall out, and then they get in the drains, they blow away, and then they get in the water, and then they get in the ocean. Which you know, we have this big Pacific garbage patch that's bigger than Texas. So that's another problem, too.
We're speaking with Alana Semuels, staff writer at The Atlantic. She's written a piece entitled, Is This the End of Recycling? The solutions here, what, with our water bottles, go back to glass, but then they become more expensive, right? I don't know. What are solutions?
The easiest solution is just to consume less stuff, but that's going to be a pretty hard sell. You know, the American economy is kind of based on consumption. You see a few companies that are trying to get people to buy reusable things. So, for instance, there's a company that's trying to get you to sign up for its service, and they send you brand name items in reusable tins. So you could get your, you know, Haagen-Dazs ice cream in a reusable metal tin, and then you send it back at the end of the day. But that's obviously pretty expensive, and there's greenhouse gases emitted from bringing it back and forth. I mean, I think the best solution is to get companies to think about packaging and how they make things and what they're making things out of. But right now, it's just so cheap to make things out of plastic. Petroleum is cheap, and it's just, you know, there's no motivation for them to think about it, especially, you know, public companies that have shareholders they have to report to. If they're just going to say, hey, we're going to make things a little more expensive so we can be good for the environment, there's really no incentive for that so far. So my opinion is maybe some sort of government action, but, you know, the government isn't exactly passing a lot of stuff right now, so it might take a while.
Other countries have the same problem that we do?
Yeah, I would say other rich countries do. You know, there's some countries that have adopted a totally different approach. Taiwan, for instance, you have to basically bring your trash and recycling out to a truck every night. You kind of don't put it in a bin. And that's actually worked a lot in getting people to think about what they're consuming, and they're kind of consuming less just because, you know, in America and a lot of other rich countries, you just kind of toss it away and forget about it. But once you're looking at how much you throw away every day, I think you kind of start to think about this consciously and think, whoa, this is a lot of stuff I'm going through.
Thanks, Alana. Alana Semuels, writer at The Atlantic. This portion of the program is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring is challenging, right? But there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/Gordon. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Gordon. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Gordon. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Again, the free trial begins at ZipRecruiter.com/Gordon. It's 23 minutes after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for being with us. Streaming music and video services that permit multiple users, plus the proliferation of family cell phone plans in recent years that are cheaper than individual accounts, have created ties that bind long after a breakup or even divorce. Here's This Morning's Jennifer Koshenka.
Breaking up is bad enough, but it's even worse if you share passwords. Sarah Krauss of the Wall Street Journal has written about this dilemma when it comes to streaming movie subscriptions, video services, and friends and family cell phone plans, and joins us now. Sarah, what are couples doing about these shared passwords when they break up?
Some couples are just keeping their current arrangements in place. They keep paying their respective bills for shared streaming services and continue sharing their passwords even after they've broken up.
What are some of the reasons that they're keeping it?
Some of it's about convenience. It's time-consuming and in some cases not even possible to export your viewing or your listening preferences to a new account. On cell phone bills, it can be particularly tricky to move on to a new plan and get both people to go to a store or give consent to make changes to an account. And in other cases, it's just a monetary question. It saves both members of the couple money to keep sharing those services.
Is there a big cost advantage to keeping it rather than going to an individual plan?
I mean, there can be if you are sharing the cost between the two of you, you know, for a Spotify, you know, family plan, $14.99 a month divided by two, you know, versus, you know, one person paying that, or even splitting a solo plan is about $10 a month. So that's, you know, $5 each versus $10 each. You know, for Netflix, you know, you're talking anywhere from $9 to $13, you know, at the sort of low end of their plan base. So that is a way to save money if you sort of go on in on it together.
Now, Sarah, I know for your story, you talked to a number of couples. Share some of those stories with us about how they approach this.
Yeah, so there's one student that I talked to who is on a Spotify premium plan with several friends and her ex-boyfriend, and she just sends a Venmo charge to each of them bimonthly and, you know, collects their part of the bill that way. Another couple that I talked to, you know, one member paid for Hulu and the other paid for Netflix and Spotify, so they sort of, you know, divided the cost of those plans between them and either, you know, found a way to split the cost down the middle in terms of the plans they paid for, or you know, used modern payment apps and tools to just send each other the money that's owed.
We're speaking with Sarah Krause of the Wall Street Journal. I would imagine, too, that this sometimes does not work out if it's not a great breakup.
No, it's not for everyone, and there are privacy concerns to think about as well. You know, do you want somebody, you know, being able to see your viewing habits or your listening habits, or in the case of a cell phone plan, you know, depending on who the primary account holder is, you know, who you're calling or texting. So there are serious privacy concerns to consider in doing this, and this arrangement is definitely not for everyone.
What do companies think about this?
I mean, some of the streaming services have cut down on the number of simultaneous viewers or watchers. So you have seen some changes to plan structures as a result of that, where you have to pay extra if you want simultaneous viewing or listening.
This morning's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Krause. It is 30 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News.
At Dell, we know running a small business takes hard work. As a thank you, for all of Small Business Month, we're offering up to 45% off select computers with Intel Core processors. Plus, get additional savings when you call a Dell Small Business Technology Advisor. Call 877-BUY-DELL today. That's 877-BUY-DELL. Additional savings valid May 6th through 30th at 8 a.m. Eastern on select computers from customer calls Dell. Excludes Dell Canvas, PowerEdge T30, and select order codes.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Patty Poppes, president and CEO of Consumers Energy, instead.
All of the innovation that's occurring around robotics, AI, it's happening here in Michigan. We have chemical companies, we have pharmaceutical companies, we have medical device manufacturers. Michigan is a magnet for innovators and dreamers.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
America's First News is online all the time. Follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show, like us on Facebook, or send us an email, thismorning@compassmedianetworks.com.
Monday, May 27, Memorial Day. Gordon Deal, Jennifer Koshenka, thanks for spending part of your holiday with us. Coming up this half hour, the full-time lawyer who also has 13 side hustles. Also, as baby boomers and millennials grab headlines, the lost Generation X is asking, hey, what about us? And the Massachusetts Air Force veteran walking across America. We'll have his story in about 20 minutes. Cell phone numbers have become a primary way for tech companies like Facebook to uniquely identify users and secure accounts, in some ways becoming a proxy for a national ID. This is a problem because that over-reliance on cell phone numbers ironically makes them a less effective and secure authentication method. More from Scott Rosenberg, technology editor at Axios. Scott, explain.
There was a story about Facebook. Facebook got into a little bit of hot water, as it has tended to do these days, when users found that the phone numbers that they were giving Facebook to use for two-factor authentication, which is when you give a service your cell phone number so that they can double check after you give them a password that it's really you. And so people who were giving Facebook this phone number for that purpose were finding that they could be looked up on Facebook using that phone number. In other words, you were giving Facebook this phone number for the purpose of securing your phone, and Facebook was connecting it to your profile and letting people find you that way. So that was the headline, and I looked at that and sort of looked at it in a broader context of how our phones are becoming a proxy for our identity in the same way that Social Security numbers did.
All right, so explain the concerns here with regards to the cell phone sort of becoming a default national ID, as you point out.
Since we now have our phone numbers essentially for life, ever since about 15 years ago when the government said that you can keep your cell phone number, you know, whenever you switch providers, you're going to keep the number. And of course, we want to do that because it's convenient. Suddenly, technology services, which are always looking for ways to identify us because the internet itself doesn't really have a built-in identity system, which is why we all now have this nightmare of a million passwords that we're trying to juggle and manage. They have latched on to the phone. Most of us carry it around all the time. It's a unique number. It's something that we can, to some extent, trust because we know that we are, you know, if somebody sends you a message on your phone, you're getting it. No one else is getting it. So we think, okay, it's pretty secure and it's unique. It's like an ID, except the problem is it's also a phone number. And the phone number is something that's out there. It's not something that any of us thought to secure because, in fact, it's how we help people connect with us, right? Here's my number.
We're speaking with Scott Rosenberg, technology editor at Axios. He's written a piece entitled Phone Numbers Are the New Social Security Numbers. So I guess are we getting to a point where we may just decide to change cell phone numbers to be less unique to technology companies?
I think people who are very concerned about privacy have options. I mean, you can get yourself what they call a burner phone where you're just buying a phone that is what you use for extreme privacy needs. You know, there are services you can use that will encrypt things more fully. You know, there are all kinds of individual steps people can take, but the fact is that most people don't do those things because they're inconvenient. So I don't think social security numbers have been around for, 75 years, 80 years, and they weren't supposed to be an ID number, and now they're a tax ID and a health ID, and they have all kinds of uses. And they also enable all kinds of scams and frauds, as we know, if the wrong people get a hold of them. And I think that that's really the scenario that we're facing with cell phone numbers. I don't think it's going to change.
Thanks, Scott. Scott Rosenberg, technology editor at Axios. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Here's a question for you. How many side hustles could you handle at one time? And would that number change if you already had a full-time job? MarketWatch reporter Maria LaMagna spoke to a guy who has 13 gigs in addition to working full-time as an attorney. Maria, what does he do?
It's not all things that are completely passive. I thought maybe that was part of the key to his success, but actually a lot of them are pretty active things. He does rent out a room in his home on Airbnb, which is one of his hustles, and then he does a few things for dogs. He participates in Rover, which he described as kind of like Airbnb for dogs, where you actually let a dog stay with you in your house, so he takes care of dogs that way. He also walks dogs. That's separately, like not even the same dog. He will walk dogs on his lunch break sometimes, ones that are close to his office. He does a lot of different delivery services like Postmates, DoorDash. He'll actually make food deliveries on his bike, which he rides to and from work. So he'll kind of try to shoehorn a delivery into his already, the commute that he's already doing. It would take forever to say all the different 13 ones that he does, but I think those are the ones he does the most often.
Why does he do so many?
Part of it is that he's experimenting to see which ones he likes the most, and he even said some of them he has abandoned once, not included in the 13, but at different times he's, tried 14 or 15 and then abandoned one or two. So he's in the process of kind of seeing which ones he likes the most, but he also said he genuinely enjoys it. You know, he likes to bike for exercise, so he feels like he's kind of getting paid to commute if he just does a delivery on the way. Sometimes he and his wife even do the deliveries together, and they view it as like a fun time that they can spend together. He said he really likes dogs and he already has a dog himself, so letting one more dog stay with them is not a big deal. So yeah. I think it's almost like a competitive nature. He feels you know, he can take advantage of all his free time and kind of monetize it. And so, yeah, he's not even paying off debt. He's completely done paying off his student loans. So it's really just like a all positive thing at this point.
Yeah, what does he make per month or say per gig with some of these things?
Yeah, so Airbnb is the most lucrative. He says that's usually about $500 or $600 a month. And in total, between everything that he does, he usually makes about $2,000 a month. So, you know, for just side hustle money, that's quite a bit, especially since he does work full-time and his wife works full-time as well.
Jeez. We're speaking with Maria LaMagna, personal finance reporter at MarketWatch. She's written a piece entitled, "This Full-Time Lawyer Also Has 13 Side Hustles. Here's What He's Learned." So what do you think he's learned from all this, other than he has to figure out when to sleep, I presume?
Right. Well, the number one thing I really took away from our conversation was he was really preaching about using your existing schedule to create your side hustles. You know, he talked a lot about trying to just incorporate things into your daily activities. So if you do have a commute or access to a car or a bike like he does, you know, maybe you can go just a little bit out of your way to make a delivery. Or, you know, he already has a dog, so he figured if I let another dog stay with me, it's really not taking anything out of my normal schedule. I would already be getting up and letting my dog out, etc. So he really talked about trying to find things that work for you and not necessarily things that feel like a big lift, but things that are kind of seamless into your daily life.
How long do you think he'll keep this up, did he say?
No, he definitely seems enthusiastic about it for now, and he's not trying to reach a certain goal or anything and then stop. So it sounds like just kind of like a lifestyle choice at this point. He never talked about having an end date in mind. So, you know, I'm sure if something happened or work got really busy or something like that, he wouldn't be able to keep it up. But he said that's one of the things he likes about side hustles, that you can stop pretty easily. You know, you can just decide, oh, I'm not going to make any deliveries today or whatever it may be. And, you know, there's really no consequence to doing that.
That's something. MarketWatch reporter Maria LaMagna. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Patty Poppes, president and CEO of Consumers Energy, instead.
All of the innovation that's occurring around robotics, AI, it's happening here in Michigan. We have chemical companies, we have pharmaceutical companies, we have medical device manufacturers. Michigan is a magnet for innovators and dreamers.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
With a seemingly endless stream of attention on millennials and the aging boomers, Gen X has been feeling forgotten, unappreciated, and frankly, a bit left out. Dugan Arnett, features writer at the Boston Globe, has been looking into it. Dugan, how'd you come across this?
It kind of happened, I guess, by happenstance, but in the last couple months, there's just been these weird little instances of Generation Xers kind of being left off, either from studies or off of like graphics that various news stations have kind of put online. And I think, you know, Xers have kind of gotten a kick out of it. I mean, I don't think anybody's too offended per se, but it just kind of goes to that long-standing belief, I guess, that generation is just kind of overlooked and passed over and that sort of thing.
That's funny. I guess I'm considered an old Xer, but we're not as big, right? We don't have the we don't have the muscle that the baby boomers are a big lot, right? The millennials are a big lot. We just don't have the bodies.
The numbers aren't in your favor. You know, boomers, there's tons of them, and millennials as well. But there's a good yeah, I can't remember exactly the numbers, but there's a good size difference, I guess, in the Gen Xers, which I'm sure probably plays into that feeling of disrespect or being overlooked a little bit.
All right, so what kind of anecdotes are you hearing?
Just little examples of how these things kind of happen in everyday life. And, you know, where millennials and boomers just grab all of the attention and Xers are kind of just left to kind of fend for themselves.
So give me one for example. Like, did you talk to somebody specifically about this?
Yeah, so the funniest thing I thought was that, you know, a handful were you know, kind of aggrieved, I guess, or at least pseudo-aggrieved at the perceived lack of respect for the generation. But there's a lot of people too that were just, this is fine by us to kind of be to be out of the limelight. You know, one woman in particular said, you know, let the millennials and the boomers fight about who's ruining the world, and we'll kind of sit back and enjoy the show.
It's interesting. We're speaking with Dugan Arnett, features writer at the Boston Globe. His piece is called "As Baby Boomers and Millennials Grab Headlines, The Lost Generation X Asks What About Us." You know, it's interesting, the term millennials, too, because that group doesn't care for that term, right, if I understand that. So
Yeah. And I guess I'm technically a millennial as well. So, but I mean, it's part of the good thing, I guess, about being a Gen Xer is that, you know, I think boomers inspire a lot of, or they draw the ire, I guess, of a lot of people. And I think millennials obviously for the same, just in the sense that they're kind of viewed as, you know, always being on their phone and entitled and things like that.
Any, like expert social observers weigh in on what's happening here?
One guy I talked to who's written a book about kind of the generational breakdown and stuff like that said that one reason that there might be this lack of kind of, I guess, I don't know if it's this lack of attention or whatever you want to call it for Generation X is that there wasn't necessarily like a massive kind of societal thing going on. Like for boomers, it was kind of the 60s and thing, you know, politically and things like that. There were a lot going on. And then, you know, with millennials, obviously technology is kind of changing the whole landscape. And, there wasn't necessarily that big thing. I mean, there are obviously big things going on as Gen Xers were coming of age, but not necessarily, I guess, to the same level, I guess, as these other two generations, which also could play into that kind of, you know, lack of a true identity and that sort of thing.
Thanks, Dugan. Dugan Arnett, features writer at the Boston Globe. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News, Memorial Day style. An Air Force veteran from Massachusetts has embarked on a big journey to support other vets. William Shuttleworth is walking across America, starting in Massachusetts, ending in California. The six-month trek is the equivalent of a marathon every day. The 72-year-old from Newburyport, about 40 miles north of Boston, began his epic 3,000-mile cross-country journey a couple of Wednesdays ago. He's calling it Vets Don't Forget Vets. He told Boston 25 News he'll average about 500 miles per pair of shoes and ultimately need 6 or 7 pairs. His mission? Raise awareness for veterans' issues, homelessness, mental health, addiction. Mr. Shuttleworth plans on stopping and visiting veterans across the country in places like American Legions, VFW halls, and coffee houses. As for lodging, there will be no comfortable hotels or swanky restaurants along the way. He's carrying everything he needs on his back and plans to camp out. Mr. Shuttleworth plans on arriving at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California by Halloween. You can contribute to his GoFundMe, by the way, at Vets Don't Forget Vets. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News. As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.